This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. The coronavirus pandemic is changing everyday life for North Carolinians. Kids are out of school, people are working from home, and officials are urging people to practice social distancing. This morning, Governor Cooper ordered the state to close restaurants and bars for dine-in customers effective today at 5 p.m. Later this hour, we're going to check in with reporters around the state to hear about how their communities are doing. But first, we want to lower your blood pressure and remind you that there is one thing that all of us can do when we're stuck at home. We can dive into a good book. So we begin today with author Therese Ann Fowler. Her latest novel is called A Good Neighborhood. It starts with a premise that's probably familiar: new residents moving into a historic community and building a giant brand new house. Therese, welcome back to The State of Things.
Hi, Anita. I'm pleased to join you today.
So as I mentioned, it's obviously a really crazy moment. So I'd love to start with a question for you as an author. Why do you think fiction is important in a moment like this?
I think fiction does something that the news doesn't do for us, which is it gives us sort of the broader strokes of the story and allows us to, in some cases, escape into that. And give us some relief from the things that are happening in our daily lives, or gives us a lens through which we can better see what's happening around us and maybe process that in a way that doesn't feel like we're just sort of putting out fires in our brains all day long.
Totally. And it's been interesting. I've been digging into your book as I've been more homebound, and I've noticed so many striking parallels, like thinking a lot about neighborhoods and how they function, and then taking my dog on a walk and seeing how many people are outside, on their stoops, out with their families, kind of out and about. So I'm curious about kind of this interest in neighborhoods and how they function and where that started for you.
Well, I guess it starts where it would start for any of us. I lived in and still do live in a neighborhood. I'm a citizen of the community. And I am a full-time fiction writer, which means that everything that happens around me is grist for the mill.
So what was it in particular that sparked this novel? I mean, it had to do a lot with a tree, I think, in your backyard.
It did, yes. So I had a tree in my backyard that was the reason that my husband and I, well, particularly I wanted to buy that house in that neighborhood. And I should say that we have since moved from that house in part because of the situation with the tree. But in this case, the house that had been on the lot next door to our house had been torn down, and we knew that there was a house that would be built in its place. But the house that came to be built in its place was much grander than the house that had existed before that. And the driveway for that home was poured so that it ran all the way down the property line and was covering up a lot of the root structure for this oak tree in our backyard. And so I understood that over time there might be some impact on that tree's health. And I was watching this tree anxiously for signs of distress. And so that's the seeds, if you will, of where the story began. But at the same time, I was also having great anxiety about what was going on in the country at that time, which was in the summer of 2018. And just the news, which I thought was so bad, but has gotten so much worse since then.
Worse in a different way.
Yeah, in a different way. But it really inspired me to feel like I needed to do something with all of that anxiety. And so it became this novel that we're talking about today.
So your experience really parallels that of one of the central characters in the book, Valerie Alston Holt, and she is a Black woman. She has a teenage biracial son. Her next door neighbors, Julia and Brad, they raise their lot. They are building a pool, which kind of parallels the experience, I guess, of the driveway for you. And Valerie begins to notice some disruptions in the root structure, or what she assumes are disruptions in the root structure that are affecting the oak tree in her backyard. And so these two families do not really start off at a great place. But I'd love for you to kind of take us into the book, maybe near the beginning, and set up how this dynamic begins to unfold.
So you want me to read this first passage?
That'd be great.
Yeah, sure. All right. So here we are. We're in chapter two with Xavier, who is Valerie's 18-year-old son. And I should mention that Valerie was widowed when Xavier was just a baby. And so he and his mother have grown up very close. And so here we go. When his mother stood in their backyard taking video and crying the day the lot behind theirs was cleared, the day men with chainsaws and grinders started at dawn and continued until dusk and his ears rang for the rest of the night, he stayed there in the yard with his arm around her shoulders because that was what he could do for her. She'd done so much for him. And so Xavier was not surprised, nor were any of us, that his mother was not eager to meet the new neighbors who'd bought the freshly built house behind theirs. Valerie Alston Holt was not sure how to be friendly with the kind of people who would put up the money to tear down the old house and cut down the trees. All of the trees. People like that, she'd said more than once, for this kind of thing was happening throughout Oak Knoll now in varying degrees. People like that have no conscience. It's like they're raping the landscape, murdering it. Trees are life. Not just my life, she would add, since her fields were forestry and ecology, but life, period. They literally make oxygen. We need to keep at least 7 trees for every human on the planet, or else people are going to start suffocating. Think of that.
That's North Carolina author Therese Ann Fowler reading from her new book, A Good Neighborhood. And she's my guest now on The State of Things. So you set up this fictional community of Oak Knoll. We're introduced to these two neighbors. And I think that passage really takes you into the varying layers of tension between these two families. So there's race, there's class, there's educational background. So talk to me about kind of setting all of that up within the context of a neighborhood, a lot of intersecting identities that you really wanted to examine through the juxtaposition of these two families.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as we know, most of us who live in neighborhoods, or even if you live, say, in an apartment complex, it is a kind of a stew of all sorts of people. And in the case of Oak Knoll, which could be a neighborhood here, you know, in the Triangle, or it could be in Richmond, it could be in Atlanta, because this kind of thing is happening everywhere. What we have is mostly middle class, kind of slowly gentrifying situation in which the people, some of them are residents who have been there for a long time and are, say, retired or living off of their pensions or Social Security, while the opportunists, the builders and developers, are coming in. And the people who are buying the homes that are built there are people who, in many cases, are of a much higher social class and economic class. And so I just felt like this is what I was seeing happening around me. And it allows me to create in the story a sort of palette in which we, I think, can all sort of find ourselves in here.
Yeah. And what's interesting about how you created the book also is you have this kind of Greek chorus style narrator.
Yes.
That kind of intros and outros various chapters and serves to represent kind of the neighborhood gossip or the view from, you know, the other side of the street. So tell me about that chorus.
You know, when we set out to write books, we have to choose point of view. And the point of view that we see most often as readers are first person, in which we're with the character, you know, the I, the me, or third person, which is he, she, they. But in this narration, the neighborhood itself is telling us the story. So it's we and us. And it's a particularly rich way of narrating a story that needs a kind of outside view, but is also intimate. And so it works like, you know, say the opening of, you know, Romeo and Juliet, for example. Shakespeare, you know, says, two families alike in dignity, and then sets up the story that's to come. And I think it's especially good for stories that have, that are cautionary tales.
Yeah, I mean, and because it sets up this extra layer of tension, as you know, as a reader, you're kind of coming to your own assumptions and questions about each of these characters. But then this chorus of the neighborhood is kind of that like little devil on your shoulder reminding you like, hey, there is other gossip that you could be leaning into. So it's funny.
Yeah.
How it kind of it adds this extra layer to the experience of reading.
Right. And they don't know everything, but they know a lot. And so there's this view that is not necessarily 100% authoritative. And I thought of it when I was writing as, you know, these are the people who are observing. We are these people, you know. It's an experience for the reader to participate, I think.
So tell me a little bit more about Valerie Alston Holt, the central character. She's a professor. She's the one who owns the house with the oak tree. Talk a bit about kind of the conflict that begins to be set up between her and her neighbors.
So because her fields are forestry and ecology, she is, you know, deeply committed to any kind of environmental situation, including what's happening in her own backyard, literally. And she's also a very protective mother. So she was widowed when Xavier was about a year old. And she is a Black woman who's living in a mostly white, not just community, but professional environment. And she's very much a believer in trying to get past the racism of her youth and of earlier years. And so she has done everything that she can to make sure that, that her son grows up to feel like he's, there's a place in the book where she says, you know, I wanted to make it so that, you know, you believed yourself to be just a kid, not a Black kid. You know, she wants to get to that post-racial place that I think many of us who grew up in the 70s believed was going to happen.
So we've talked about Valerie. We've talked about her son, Xavier. Tell me about the Whitman family, this family that just moved in next door and is beginning to cause some chaos in this neighborhood.
The Whitmans are Brad Whitman, who is an entrepreneur. He has an HVAC company that he started from scratch, and sort of a traditional Southern white guy who is a by the bootstraps sort of fellow who kind of sees himself as the master of his universe. And he has married Julia Whitman, who had a 9-year-old daughter, Juniper, when she and Brad got together. She went to work for Brad at that time. And then since that time, they've had a daughter together who's Lily. So Juniper is their 17-year-old teen. And one of the complications of the novel is that she and Xavier develop this romantic attraction.
Yes, indeed. And that things get very sticky as their romantic attraction continues to develop. And what struck me is kind of how you are exploring racial and socioeconomic difference through the perspectives of people of different ages who grew up within different contexts when kind of society and social norms are really different. So talk about your intention on playing that out along the age differences between the parents and then the kids.
Julia, in particular, was a product of a very difficult upbringing and has enabled herself to marry well and change her life and change Juniper's life so that the reality that Juniper is growing up with now is very starkly different from the reality that Julia had in Eastern North Carolina as a child who grew up, you know, in a mobile home. And here they are now living in this, we would probably call it a McMansion, if we're being glib about it. And Xavier, by contrast, was just a solid middle class, very conservative in terms of his mother's values. And so class is not something that they've paid a lot of attention to because they're concerned with different things. But the kids themselves, I think, do not really see the differences the way that their parents saw them when they were growing up. They're just concerned about, like, do we like each other? And what the social differences and the economic differences are of no consequence to them. And that's kind of demonstrated by a moment when Brad buys for Juniper a really lovely luxury SUV that is probably fancier than anything that most of us could afford or ought to afford to buy, whereas, you know, Xavier's driving this 20-year-old beat-up Honda. But they don't care about any of that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there in just a second. But my last question for you is kind of in this time that you are, you know, your novel is done. Your book tour, I'm guessing, has been canceled or altered pretty significantly.
Gosh. Yeah, imploded.
Imploded, yeah. Are there any kind of themes of this novel that are carrying you through this time that are resonating in a different way because of everything that's going on?
Well, you know, the novel ends on a kind of a grace note in which, you know, the reader is encouraged to think about ways that we can be better to each other in our communities. And I think that resonates pretty strongly, frankly, with the situation we're all going through right now.
Therese Ann Fowler is the author of A Good Neighborhood. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.